Okay. Now, say that it's May 24th,
year 2000.
Tape number 5.
Tape number 5. I went home with this fellow, and we
for Thanksgiving, is that right?
Oh, no, no. Now we're in London. We're back in London. And I stripped off and jumped into bed, and he was horrified. He didn't have pajamas for me. He said, "Don't you wear underwear?" I said, "No." So he insisted that I put on underwear. So that was my first singlet, my first jockey
uh-huh.
shorts.
How old were you?
15 or 16.
Uh-huh. Did that have an impact on you?
Yeah, I think it did. In the country, I was, I wore underwear, you know, long johns and stuff, you know. I think when living away from home too, I kind of dispensed with that as a nuisance, you know. If these things were soiled, you'd throw them. But still, it's customary not to wear underwear.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Okay, now, let's go back to New York, where we were. You were talking about lofts and getting into
yeah.
them buildings. And,
yeah.
And some Thanksgiving, you mentioned.
Yeah. One Thanksgiving, there were always colleagues who were that we went to school with. And the women would prepare, the girls would get together and cook a turkey and things like that. And there were painters from Pennsylvania, there were guys from Arizona, and the Thanksgiving dinners were very splendid for us. And also Christmas dinners, as they were cobbled together, once again with a turkey and stuff like that. There was an illustrator who was studying at the Hoffman School. His name was Newton. I always remember the name Newton. And poor Newton was really a troublesome kind of a fellow who would kind of destroy any happiness that abounded. And we threw him out. We said, "We've had enough of this." And we threw poor Newton out of the loft on 2nd Avenue, the one across from the Cooper Union.
Who else was living with you at that time?
There was Arthur Teager, his brother Bobby, there were sundry girls living in there, and I think Bobby Beecham was there. No, he wasn't. There were painters on the GI Bill of Rights, and they had money and they could live very splendidly. But anyway, there's an assortment of people living in these condemned buildings. I hate to jump from one loft to anyway, we threw Newton out, and then everyone felt bad about this, and people were saying, "God, it's Christmas, and we threw that poor bastard out of here." And we thought, well, then let's get him back. So I remember fanning out across Cooper Union Square, which is a wide square on the borders of West Village, across from the Wanamaker's store, which I don't think it exists any longer. And we couldn't find this fellow. You know, I really suspect that he was hiding in a doorway just to ruin our Christmas. So we couldn't find Newton, and we all returned and then thought, the hell with this, and we just packed food to take to our homes or lofts, you know. Because people were, it was a struggle to live. And yet everyone was in the same boat. And
your money you were earning was not really sufficient? I mean, it covered...
No, I was doing well. Why I didn't buy paintings and become a millionaire like these other people, it beats the hell out of me. But I was supporting Arthur. I was Arthur Teager,
mm-hmm.
intermittently supporting the Kleins, France, and his wife. And I was the only one, I think, with a job. I had a union job, and I hesitate to say what I was earning because it seems like nothing, but it was a union-scale job in Manhattan. It was worth something. Then there were medicals. They had their own hospital and stuff like this. So I was doing all right. But I envied these other people who, who could paint all the time, even though I knew they had it rough. And I envied the guys who'd come in from New Jersey, who had jobs there, or they had family there, you know. And we kind of looked at them with a jaundiced eye. There was Alec Kupro would come in from New Jersey, but he was teaching at Princeton, I think, you know. The lofts, one loft we were in, the one I found near the Brooklyn Bridge at night, the shadows of the bridge would illumine the walls, you see, and it was just a wonderful sight. You know, I'm aware of paintings that were done of the bridge, you know. I can't think of the guy's name who made an industry out of it. But de Kooning would look at this, and finally we had to leave that building. I think the roof caved in, and a wall fell away. It was a disaster. The fire engines came and stuff like that. And
was de Kooning with you in that walk?
Yes, he was there checking that out, and he seemed to enjoy it very much.
So he didn't paint there, or he was just...
He painted there.
He did?
Yeah.
Okay.
And anyway, I went to visit him on one occasion on Long Island when the money was pouring in to him. And there was this architect who was designing a home for him. This was in the Hamptons area. And the architect said, we've got to finish this bill. You understand, we want to finish this. This is simple, and I can't come out here. You know, we should finish this. But anyway, there are two things I remember about the loft that we lived in temporarily, about eight of us. There was, once again, a little restaurant on the corner that, in front of these restaurants with a hot table, you know, like a cafeteria. You get a plate. And you'd sit down and eat. On Second Avenue, we had that little, one of these cafeterias, but small places. And they had one, and the food was delectable in that area. The food was just wonderful, ethnic, Polish, and Jewish. And there's always the loft was kind of suffused with these fragrances, you see. And also, we turn out the lights and the bridge, the dusk would bring the shadows of the bridge. And there's always something magical about a shadow. It corrects sculpture that is thrown up against the wall. And when I went to visit him some years later, I had to walk there. I had to walk a number of miles. And finally,
from the train,
went there by train, and
you remember the name of the town in Long Island?
No, I think it was Ridgehampton, but I could be wrong. I was hungry, and I thought, why the hell don't you invite me to eat something? You know, let's eat. You know, when will the invitation come? And all the time, there was the fragrance of food, you see, which aggravated my condition. And not only that, at the end of the long day, the sun was setting, and he had some beams that were cantilevered out for further construction. And they were not merely cantilevered out, but there were cross things all ready to accept a roof or wall or what have you.
So it's like a don't know what you call kind of a structure.
It was a cantilever structure to accept, you know, an addition on the building. And
scaffolding.
Scaffolding comes down, but this was kind of, it would be very reminiscent of that. Anyway, at dusk, these things were intermined into the room, you see, just like that magic place where we stayed. And then he said, "Are you hungry?" And the lady left, who was dressed in white. She looked like a nurse, but she wasn't. She was a cook. And we went downstairs, and there was a hot table, you see, of food. So for hundreds of thousands of dollars, or a million, he had recreated this, where he...
The little cafe, or little...
the little cafe, either on near Delancey or Mott Street, in that old loft that we all got run out of. But I knew there's no way that the architect would have him, would finish that. He never understood what the hell was going on. And he had him working on another side of the building. Then
was he still living with Elaine at that point, or were they separated? Do you remember seeing her on that visit?
I don't remember seeing her on that visit. And I wanted to go out there again when this, I was in New York. I was visiting Bud Holly. He says, "I wouldn't go out there if I were you. You'd get your throat cut." And I thought,
"What do you mean by that?"
He meant that he had a daughter born out of wedlock, and when we think of the art and, you know, these gestural painters, you know, we think of Franz Time, we think of William de Kooning. It's almost like Gallagher and Sheen, the musical actor. And I really had to report to Elizabeth, Franz Klein's wife, about whether he was involved with another woman. I said,
Franz.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no. And I said, but both of the boys are interested in two fine young ladies, you know. They're not as beautiful as you are. And they are the Ward sisters, who are identical twins, you see. So Franz Klein and William de Kooning were going with these women who looked exactly alike. We discovered that de Kooning was not married to Elaine de Kooning. The license wasn't signed. There was a brouhaha by her family, but she didn't have any rights except maybe under common law in New York. So she lost out. Bill was very dysfunctional, as I said. Franz really loved Elizabeth, you know, and he felt guilty about bringing her here, and her going kind of crazy, you know, the delusions of grandeur and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Was she then hospitalized or institutionalized for a long period? Or?
She was institutionalized for a long period. Sometimes she'd get violent. Once you were aware that you were in a mental home, because there were, you know, iron bars, you see, and but nothing is as bad as you paint it, like that terrible loft with that magic, you see. And I remember she loved to have her hair combed when the sun came in. At a certain time, the sun would come in, and I remember her cocking her head in front, combing her hair. You have this rainbow of color through this lady's hair, you see. And anyway, she thought it a good idea that she, that Franz should have somebody, and the Ward sister seemed like the deal, because de Kooning was going with one of the Ward sisters. So that kind of came about. I think she feared one woman, but she somehow, this was diffused by twins, you know, it seemed, you know, absurd. When William de Kooning and Franz Klein rented a summer home at Ridgehampton, there was a singular happening, namely that Bill couldn't travel abroad. I don't know why, his papers were screwed up. We had the same lawyer, but you know, I moved forward on this and I got finally legalized. I don't think he ever was legalized. He had a whole rationale for this sort of thing, but which I don't want to go into, you know, like an anarchistic viewpoint of government, you know. Well, anyway, we got the house for them. And
what do you mean by that? We got the house.
Yeah, we got this summer leasehold, summer rental.
You arranged to.
Yeah, there were a number of people who worked on this. There was a German architect. God, what's his name? He was also an occupant of this house. I can't think of his name. Damn it. A sweet little guy, and the men moved into the house, and Elaine de Kooning joined them there, and her idea was that she would put on a show as his wife. You see, so here you have this farmhouse, you know, a commodious house, a working house. We of course, as you know, we painted the toilet, and his mother, he arranged to have her brought to the United States. This is his first successful year. He sold about $15,000 worth of paintings. That's all. See, here's a guy, white-haired, in his 60s now. This is his first successful year. Down the road a ways at Springs was Jackson Pollock, and he sold a mural for $18,000, and now he's in court with Peggy Guggenheim, who claimed that that painting belonged to her, because she had, her name was on the lease of the house, and this was a condition that anything he painted there belonged to her. So he won in this matter. When you see pictures of Jackson Pollock working out at Springs, there are halls, you know, they had these eastern hemlock barns with knots missing from the wood, and where the wood had shrunk up, you can see the sky. This is where he worked. This is not just picturesque. This was a house that I think Peggy bought it for about $4,500,
$5,000. So he went
there to
live.
Yeah.
And was Springs in New York, or?
No, Springs was a little non municipal community that was kind of satellite to these towns.
What towns?
East Hampton, Southampton, Ridgehampton.
Okay, Long
Island. And it came about, it's a non-incorporated town, and it came about so that servants who worked for the rich folk in the mansions, this would be where they would live, you see. So the artist glommed onto that. Motherwell dragged a Quonset hut there and lived in Springs. Barney Ross at Grove Press moved there. No, he bought, yes, he moved there and lived there. And the Zogbaums, Captain Rufus Zogbaum, had a house there. Because he was there, they all learned about Springs. His son, Zogbaum, was a pretty fair sculptor.
Z-O-G-B-A-U-M.
And Smith, the sculptor, worked on...
David Smith?
Yeah, was also a resident at Springs and did work there.
What about Lee Krasner? Was she involved with Pollock at that time?
Yes, she was his wife.
Was she living there?
Yes, she was, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember her. I had the unenviable task of running Pollock off, you know. For some reason, he was scared of me. He was drunk. When
you
he was
ran
drunk.
Him off? Or he
yeah,
ran,
no, I ran him off. He would come by the house in spring, in Ridgehampton, and he would sideswipe cars. Yeah, and Klein's house, and would wreck furniture. He, when he was drunk, he was terrible. I know that his first success was just bludgeoned by that terrible woman, Peggy, see? And he went on a rampage. It was Lee who went to court and fought for that money, you know. Of course, he got a Time magazine decided, a Life magazine, I'm sorry, decided that something should be done about this odd ball bunch. And they fixated on Pollock. What he did seemed so absurd that it was worthy of caricature. And they fixated on Pollock. They didn't want to hear anything about the other stuff, but Pollock was the one. So they fixated on him as some sort of yokel. And there was no gainsaying the fact that it started a groundswell of affection for this cowboy, or neo-cowboy, hornswoggling these people in New York. And there were machines you could buy at fairs and in novelty shops where you poured paint in a container and you turned the thing around, it would create a Jackson Pollock. And his work came in to demand because of this orchestrated insult. And the people of Cotto, Wyoming wanted him back to run for the Senate. They said anyone who could hornswoggle a bunch of New Yorkers is worthy. We have, like, Stuart Hart Benton is the only one that they could compare him to. They wanted him back in Cody. Not that he was ever born there, you know. I think he went to high school there. But anyway,
no, he went to, as I recall, he was born there, I think, but they moved to California.
Yeah, Florida, yeah, to California.
Mm-hmm. California.
Yeah.
Stuart Hart Benton. Wasn't it some other name? Something Hart Benton?
Yeah, that was a painter, but his brother was Senator Benton.
Oh, okay. Huh.
Anyway, but there was a groundswell of affection for this guy's work, you know, to somehow people realized. And also, when he was sober, he was really magical. Some fool said, this is against nature. And his answer to this was, I am nature, you see. And he was just crazy. But when he was drunk, he was really an ugly son of a bitch. He would bully young painters. He was really bad news. Anyway, so this strange scene occurs. Poor Elizabeth is still institutionalized, and de Kooning at long last brings his mother with great pride to America. And nothing prepared anyone for the sight of that lady. She looked like some black figure from a painting by Rembrandt. Her clothes were black, and she was tough with huge hands. This was a tough lady. She was a prostitute most of her life, and that, like most successful prostitutes, became the owner of a tavern, you see, of a waterside tavern. And if someone would get wise-ass with her, a sailor, she'd grab the son of a bitch and throw him right into the canal, you see.
And what city did she live in?
Rotterdam. She was tough with a square head, and this woman comes onto the farmhouse in Ridgehampton, the place with the outhouse with three holes, you know. She comes onto this, and Elaine is putting on a show as the loving wife, doing things she hasn't done in years, like trying to bake cookies, which were a disaster. And meanwhile, of course, Klein is ensconced with one of the ward girls. I'm mixed up in the name, so we'll call them the ward sisters. And but the other ward gal who loved de Kooning, and she did, would hover around, you see. Anyway, on the second day in appraising Elaine de Kooning, his mother said, the ward gal turned up, I don't know, with cookies or something like that, to say hello. And this old whore grabbed the ass of the ward, Mary Ward would call her, and said, "This is what you need to give me a son. I need a son, a boy, a child. You understand? You're wasting your life. You're destroying mine. Look, this woman can give you a baby." And then turning to Elaine, she said, "This woman is barren. She'll never give you a baby." You know, God, it's like something out of another world, you know. And anyway, there was tears and uproar over this. And then we all had a picnic. Faye Lantzner, actually. Yeah. Lantzner, and an N follows the S. Lantzner. Lantzner, yeah. And anyway, we all went to this public beach, and there was a barbecue stand and stuff like that. And they found this huge throne-like chair for his mother. You know, God, I'll never forget the sight. It was a moon over, you know, over the sea. And her son, her 62 or 64-year-old baby, had his head in her lap, in her black, and she was stroking his hair. And he promised that he'd produce a child. And yes, that woman, he'll pursue her. After all, I'm an artist, and, you know, women, I don't trust me, mother said he.
And mom told him, so he's going
to... Yeah, so it was legal for him to do this. Anyway, there was a huge hurricane which destroyed all the summer's work in the barn. They had paintings and papers in the barn. And these were strewn all over the landscape. And they had these municipal workers and military. You could see these abstract paintings and throw them in bloody garbage. I swear to God, that the following year, this stuff was selling for tens of thousands of dollars. Then for millions of dollars. And I'll never forget the sacks of garbage in the municipal trucks and going to the landfill, you know. But I had some other problems on my mind, you know. We were alive, that was the main thing. And I had to report back to Elizabeth about, you know, what's going on here. I said, well, nothing much really, but I think that Bill is going to marry the ward girl, you know, and Franz is going with the other lady. She's not as beautiful as you are, believe me. Elizabeth, we've got to do something. She's a nice girl, you'd love her. And so he never married the ward gal that he went with, you see. And he didn't marry her. And she bore him a daughter, you see, who was a spitting image of a mother. I've never seen her. I've just seen photographs of her. And she was...
Of the ward. You've never seen the ward girl?
No, not in...
You saw Franz's, de Kooning's mother, though.
Yes.
But you didn't see the ward girl when she arrived?
I didn't see...
when the mother grabbed her by the ass, you didn't see that?
I saw that, but I didn't see the issue. I didn't see the baby that was born to the ward girl.
Got it. Okay.
You see?
Yeah.
I never seen her, but every now and again I read about it in the paper. I'm thinking of how we lived in condemned buildings now, you know, I'm explaining, making good of that.
Yeah.
And this young lady comes before the court and says, I can't possibly live on $8,000 a month. She is single, she's in a motorcycle gang. And the motorcycle gang was accused of smuggling dope, you know. They were these Harley Davidson folk, the leather jacketed people. And they became ensconced in the studios of De Kooning out on Long Island. And if you wanted a De Kooning cheap, these boys would deliver it on a motorbike, you see. And they would get quite angry and ugly with other people who had a legitimate reason for being there, you see. This young lady was arrested for taking, you know, narcotics, stuff like that. And the her defense counsel, this is a lawyer who had served artists in shape or form, you know. I think he helped me once on an immigration problem. Can't think of his name. So the reason for this, Your Honor, is that her father is a wealthy artist, you see. The value of his paintings is in the millions of dollars, and she is struggling along on a pitiful $8,000 a month. So the court agreed to give her $25,000 a month, and she promised to clear up her act. That's how justice works.
Now, how did you find out about all this?
I read this. Yeah, read this, and then and I saw a photograph of her once in a leather jacket, and I thought, my God, there's the square head of a mother, you know, and the jacket of a grandmother, yeah. And I thought, there's nothing of Mary or the other ward, you know, there's nothing, just this dynamic block of wood, you know. And then I wanted to go out there and see her, you see, and see Bill. But by this time, something very disquieting happened. We got a letter asking for contributions to bury Elaine de Kooning, you see.
Now, how long ago was this?
God, when was that?
I think it's been something like 10 years, maybe.
10 years, yeah. Okay. And I thought, my God, couldn't the estate do something, you know? But no, the state didn't do anything. And de Kooning had kind of advanced to a state of senility or Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
He had no memory or recollection of anything. And his paintings were strictly linear. There was none of this, you know, none of these emotional serrations or, you know, accidents or unconscious acts. And I swear to God, the last paintings were in sort of gentle pinks, reds, blacks, and I always think of the Brooklyn Bridge, the lights that came through, and of course the paintings were attacked as being done by an Alzheimer's person, but they're really pure. He could still do this, you know. He put on his bib and tucker coveralls and go out there and paint, but this time with, you know, just a great sense of peace and happy memories.
Almost like a flat line.
Yeah, flat line. Yeah. Hmm. People came to the village all over the world. If you're an artist, that's where you could survive, and that's where you could study. But there are other people who came to the village that I became involved with. Wilhelm Reich was follower of Sigmund Freud.
Wait, before you go ahead, were you living in the village?
Yes.
You lived at de Kooning's place or Klein's place? Do you have
another I lived on Thompson Street.
Greenwich Village.
Yeah,
I'm getting mixed up. I'm thinking of that village out or whatever.
Oh, Ridgehampton.
Ridgehampton or Springs or whatever.
No, we're back in New York.
Okay,
we're back in New
back
York.
In, yeah, you lived in the village.
The things that you could do.
Okay.
I had a friend, Chuck Mongraviti, whose father was the head of the art department at Columbia. He was the one who said that Picasso and Matisse have discovered everything. It's our job to consolidate their discoveries and not mess around. And these people in the village are just idiots. So Chuck did not agree with his father, of course. And he was an engineer, and Chuck was the prime contractor for orgone boxes, and he had a, and he said, if you're not doing anything, if you're getting fed up going out to, you know, the garment industry, he said, you could help me with these orgone boxes, you see. And it was like building an outhouse, really, very simple structure, and they were layered in a certain way with the metal outside and with the organic inside, like wood or excelsior, and a little seed in there, just lacking a hole that would turn it into an outhouse. And people would happily sit in there, and I thought this was the funniest thing. And but it was dangerous because all these things were forbidden. And if you had a book by Wilhelm Reich, under the law at that time, the FBI could enter your premises and seize that book and seize you.
Because Reich was
He was in.
This is illegal.
Yeah, he was. He was a federal prisoner. I think he died in prison. He finally, I think he had a laboratory in, not in upstate New York, but I think in New Hampshire, in blueberry country. And the farmers there adored him. They loved him. They needed rain, and they go and talk to Wilhelm Reich, and he'd give them rain, stuff like that. He had a defense against flying saucers. I joined a flying saucer group who were looking out for flying saucers. I was kicked out because they all swore they saw a flying saucer. I was intoxicated or drunk or asleep, and I said, no, I didn't see anything, so out I went. And also, you could make these simple boxes and be arrested. I thought that was very thrilling. So I made orgone boxes. Then Chuck ran into some other guy who had fled some major company like Hughes with a design for a potentiometer. Potentiometers, he said, are very primitive things, and we, you know, at the ear, you know, at the dawning of the atomic age, we need a potentiometer that can give you a reading to a quarter of a million rather than one in 50. So he was on the run from his company, who had private investigators searching for him. So it was logical that he would wind up in the village, and he'd set up a lathe in a bathroom of this cold water flat, and he was doing the building this super instrument. So that was another, all in the same building, these dramas are going on. You see people with bringing in these heavy machines, you know, working at night. And I helped Chuck Mongravini with Ed Weissner, was his name, a physicist who had fled. And the FBI were now looking for him, because this was a component of atomic bombs. I thought, well, I better get out of this area, said I to myself, in much the same way I said I got to leave England when I moved into 10th Street, because de Kooning said there's a place down below, you'd like it. He lived on the second floor. No, the first floor, sorry. We were in the basement here. Myself and a fellow named Danny Brody, and occasionally Robert De Niro, who had been a great disaster, befell him. He kicked him out of the condemned building, which is now the law school for NYU, you see. So he would occasionally drift in there. Meanwhile, I was intrigued by the building and the people there. Everyone had this ragged, bohemian patina about them. You know, as though they'd been pissed upon, like when, like L'Homme le Mouton. And but there was a girl who didn't seem part of this. And I thought, my God, who is this? This is a beauty. And she was Miss Potato Queen of Iowa, you know, this big thing. I thought, my God, this is America, and they don't have princes, or they have these are the princesses of America. I thought it was a splendid idea. And she had a boyfriend who was very troubled, and but he didn't have much to say to anyone. I didn't know what the hell they were doing. What are you doing in the village? You know? And the girl was encouraging to her man, and she was with him all the time. He wore a collar and tie at all times. Then I went to an opening at Poindexter, and we were visited by Anand Lal, his wife. This was the Indian ambassador. And under this policy of to go to any show that involves a Dominion painter, here I am, I'm on the run from the immigration. I didn't really welcome this interest. But I met this lady, and she invited me to have dinner at the embassy. And I went back to the little building on 10th Street, and I told Gandhi, yes, can I come? I said, no, she just invited me, man. And I told de Kooning about this. And somehow this young lady learned about this, you know, in the course of things. And then...
Which young lady?
The
beautiful girl with
the beautiful
boyfriend?
Girl.
With the boyfriend.
Yeah, yeah.
Learned about the situation?
Yeah, she did, in this little building. She told her husband about it. Meanwhile, everyone was worried about me. You don't have clothes, but I did have clothing, and people coming up with ties and shirts, you see, and had to polish my shoes and stuff like that. I had to watch it because I'm going to eat with these people. And Anand Lal was respected. He wrote, I think, Charterhouse at Palmer, a classic novel of transformation of India and its people. The truth is, I don't know whether he was the Indian or the Pakistani ambassador. But the name's Anand Lal. Anyway, and also they thought that I shouldn't go in the subway. You know, the embassy was in the 70s, and that I should go by taxi. So they all coughed up money for me to go uptown in a taxi. And here I am preening myself in a mirror, you see, and I go out to the taxi, and this young man comes running down, grabs me, pulls me away from the taxi, and this is his story. He says, my name is Philo T. Farnsworth. My father invented television, and what did he get for this? Nothing. Works, he earns $15,000 a year, which seemed like a generous sum of money 50 years ago. But he invented television. And he said, I'm told you're going to see the Indian ambassador. Tell him I have an atom bomb the size of a soccer ball. Yes, tell him that I have an atom bomb for him. It's in the building here. Tell him. And shoved back in the cab, and that's the village. His name was Philo T. Farnsworth. I read up about this. I thought, that son of a bitch has got a little atom bomb in that fucking building. I'm getting out of here. But then how naive am I to think that by going from 10th Street to 15th Street, you know, I'd be safe, you know. But that was Philo T. Farnsworth, who lived above de Kooning on 10th Street. I think that in my peripheral vision was a guy named Lee Salisbury, whose daddy owned a bookstore on the other side of 10th Street, you see, but I never saw him. I don't think I ever was in there looking for books. There was another painter in the building named Maccabee. He was very busy, very industrious. God, how I envied him. I thought, so young, and to be so disciplined, you know, none of this all-night parties and stuff like that, you know. And then a couple of years went by. I asked about him. They said, oh, he died. So this young guy of 26 died, you know, leaving nothing, really. So I think of Philo T. Farnsworth and his goddamn bomb. You know, I'm wondering, you know, what happened. And he's saying that then he was giving, he's chasing after the cab and saying, the Secretary of State will give them a license. They are an allied nation and stuff like that. All it needs is a license from the Secretary of State. Yes, okay, fine. And I didn't go back to the building where de Kooning lived because of this bloody maniac. You know, I thought, am I being had? But then I went to the library and read about his daddy. And his daddy was the first one to come forth with a coherent signal. You know, none of this cathodic ray stuff and, you know, engineers perusing what had happened. He was inspired by a plowed field, said the elder Farnsworth, and his company, Progressor, was making atom bombs, and his son glommed onto one.
God.